The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Logan Shannon, in for Virginia Prescott. In 2014, British teenager Jessica Vine shaved her head and donated her hair to raise money for cancer research. Her charitable act was rewarded with an order not to come back to school without a wig. The story speaks to hair as commodity and symbol. Both strains are rooted far back in global culture. From Victorian mourning jewelry to religious sacrifice to fake weaves, hair is freighted with meaning and one of the most versatile and sought-after fibers in the world. The hair industry is now a billion-dollar global industry that you probably haven't heard much about, and those in the trade would like to keep it that way. Emma Tarlow is a professor of anthropology at Goldsmiths, University of London. Her book, Entanglement, The Secret Lives of Hair, follows her three-year trek across countries and continents in search of the global hair trade. Virginia spoke with her about her research.
So, billion-dollar industry. Where does most of this hair come from, and where does it go?
Well, a very large proportion of the hair is collected up in various sort of South and Southeast Asian countries, India, China, Myanmar, Vietnam, places like that. A lot of the hair then gets transported to China, which is the sort of biggest center in terms of factories for wigs and hair extensions. Some of it will get exported directly from countries like India to the United States, to Europe, and really every continent is buying hair.
You visited some of those factories where wigs are now manufactured in China, but it also turns out that China has been a kind of central source for hair and hair work since the early 1900s. What can you tell us about the origins there?
Yes, that was really interesting, actually, because I sort of rather assumed that this was a sort of contemporary global trade. But once I started doing the research, I realized that in Europe and America, we'd been importing hair from China, as you say, really actually from the late sort of 19th century onwards. And there was a big trade, particularly in the early 1900s, in hair nets made out of human hair. And these were hair nets that were incredibly popular in the United States and were worn by women during the day. And they were actually hand-knotted using sort of individual or sometimes double strands of hair. And they were usually made in China by women and children. So that's an old trade that goes back a very long way.
So how do today's systems work differently? You know, they're all mechanized and on a global scale moving around very quickly.
Yes, it's interesting. I mean, a lot of the work is actually still very much done by hand. You know, the sort of sorting out of strands of hair into the appropriate lengths, the tying it up and all those things that are done very much by hand, hackling it, which means sort of combing it on metal spikes. But some of the things have become mechanized, like they may have sort of ovens that with sort of self-timers for sort of baking curl into hair, or machines, sewing machines, which are sort of triple-headed sewing machines, which are good for stitching hair wefts. So some of those things are done by machine. But there are still many factories and workshops where people are literally hand-knotting the wigs, you know, and the sort of custom-made high-end hair pieces are often hand-knotted individually, strand by strand, or two or three strands at a time.
I have to say, your book made me think about how this trade is going on that most people have no idea about. How did you stumble onto this?
Yes, oddly enough, I came into it through quite a strange angle, really. I'd been doing research about sort of hair covering practices amongst Muslims in Britain and around the world. And I was interested in how people are sort of trying to combine ideas of fashion and modesty and identity within head coverings. And whilst I was researching that in the sort of Islamic context, I became interested in how Orthodox Jewish women were also wearing hair coverings, but they were covering their hair with hair. So they were wearing wigs. So that sort of sparked my curiosity as to where the hair was coming from. And then I happened to stumble across this controversy that had taken place in 2004 when some Orthodox rabbis became very concerned that a lot of the hair that was coming into the Orthodox Jewish market was coming from Hindu temples in India. And they were concerned as to whether that hair was kosher or not. So once I started sort of becoming aware of those things, I became very fascinated, really, in that something so intimate and personal as hair that sort of grows on your own head could actually be sort of transiting around the world to such a great extent and become incorporated into people's lives, you know, in very, very different sort of cultural contexts.
Well, and in 2004, what you were speaking about, there was a burning, a mass burning of wigs of Orthodox Jewish women.
Yes, I mean, this particular rabbi who was based in Israel, a 94-year-old rabbi, much revered, basically declared that this hair wasn't kosher and that asked women to burn it because he felt that it was, you know, wrong for it to land up on somebody's head, even if it was given to charity. He was concerned that it might end up on a Jewish person's head and that this was inappropriate because he considered this Hindu form of worship a form of idol worship, and he felt it was inappropriate for Jewish women to be connected to that.
Well, this brings up a couple of different things. One is that the huge projections that we make upon hair, that
yes,
how one is supposed to look. And also going back to that China point and this rabbi's point, that hair is this strange way of mixing cultures, you know, women's hair from Southeast Asia ending up on the heads of women in Europe or in Israel.
Yes, and one of the fascinating things is there's a very big trade in combings, which is just hair that falls out during the combing and washing process. So that hair is being collected up sort of on doorsteps throughout Asia, and that gets sent to untangling workshops. And then it goes on to China to go to the wig factories and hair extension factories. But that means that sort of a single wig at the sort of lower end of the market may actually be containing the hair of really hundreds of different women, you know, even from different countries.
So they're not even shaving it off in this case, but using the combings, and there is a market for that. But there's a kind of fetishization that people collect hair on the side of the road. Part of it is economic, but what else is in there?
Well, I mean, in many cultures, there's the idea that hair that's come from your head is sort of dangerous in a way. It can be used for malpractice. It can be used for magic and so forth. So there are a lot of old customs of sort of burying hair or burning hair, sort of getting rid of waste hair. But because there is a market for it now, people are willing to sell it. And that sort of other side of it gets sort of downplayed. And then there's the religious context where people are willing to sort of renounce their hair as a sort of gesture of humility, or in the Hindu case, you know, in fulfillment of a vow they may have made to the gods in South India. And so there are various different contexts from which the hair emerges into the market that are very different, actually. I mean, the sort of religious donations are very, very different from someone selling hair for poverty or someone selling combings, which is really a form of recycling of what would otherwise go to waste.
I'm speaking with Emma Tarlow. She's a professor of anthropology and author of Entanglement, The Secret Lives of Hair. She tracked it down all over the globe to find out more about the massive, and we're talking billion-dollar, global hair trade. Is some hair more valuable than others?
Yes. I mean, basically, a lot of the hair that's available on the market enters into the market black. I mean, it can be bleached and dyed, but it kind of loses value through the processing because it gets damaged to some extent. And therefore, if you can sort of obtain, you know, European blonde hair, which is sometimes known as virgin gold or auburn hair, you know, these are sort of more unusual colours that are difficult to get hold of. And if they are cut directly from the head rather than sort of mixed up combings, then these are the types of hair that are considerably more expensive than other hair. So it's called virgin hair if it hasn't been treated at all. And it's called remi hair if it's been cut in such a way that the cuticles are all still pointing from the scalp down to root to point, it's called in the industry. So if the hair is kept arranged in that way, it's a lot more valuable than if it's combings that have been mixed up, because those tangle a lot. And in order to get them untangled, after sorting them out into beautiful bunches, they then have to be sort of dipped in a kind of acid bath that removes the cuticle, and that weakens the hair. So that's considerably less valuable on the market.
So virgin gold, which has associations with blonde, which has associations with white, You travel to places like Senegal, where there is a brisk trade being done in hair that really looks white. There are so many associations between hair and race. In what you did, going all around the world, what did you find about that relationship between the two?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting because amongst many African-American women and amongst black women in Britain, there's, you could say, a natural hair movement. So there's some people are quite concerned to appreciate natural hair fiber and not to sort of feel the need to add extra fiber. But on the other hand, there's a very lively ancient tradition of African hair arts in which, you know, fiber was often added. So there are different sort of histories that people draw on. And in terms of the marketing of hair, it's quite interesting the way in which sort of ethnic labels are sort of used to convey the idea of a certain sort of hair. So Brazilian hair or Peruvian hair or Indian hair, they all have a certain connotation, whereas Chinese hair is never really advertised as Chinese hair because there's this feeling that if it was advertised as Chinese, people might not buy it. They might not associate it with the right type of associations. They might associate it with being cheaply made in China or so on. So there's a lot of labeling which sort of plays on the idea of ethnic difference, even though the actual hair in the packets may actually be the same hair.
Well, we've been speaking mostly about the idea of wigs, and it is interesting because oftentimes, this sounds like a very female-centric supply and demand trade. You know, women are sort of producing the hair and buying it on the other end, though not exclusively. But they are not generally the people who are profiting from it. So who is?
Well, a lot of the big traders, it's true, are men. I wouldn't say men are, you know, men's participation as purchasers of hair is much more invisible than women's, because there are a lot of men buying hair pieces and getting custom-made hair pieces made up. And sometimes these are actually glued onto the scalp in such a way that you wouldn't have any idea that that person is wearing a hair piece. So I did come across situations where, you know, wives were not aware of their husbands actually having hair pieces, because the husbands would go on the quiet to have the thing taken off and sort of a new piece put on maybe every 3 weeks or every 4 weeks. And otherwise they were leading, you know, a normal life, swimming and showering and things without ever removing their hair. So there's a kind of invisible quality to the male side of buying hair covering.
The whole trade is sort of invisible on many levels. There's a certain kind of, I don't know, I'm going to say sordidness associated with it. I mean, why go to such lengths to keep this on the DL?
Well, it's interesting. It is a body part, and it's sort of both a body part and a sort of byproduct of the body. And I think we as humans are kind of nervous about the idea of and concerned about the idea of trading in sort of human parts. I mean, there's also a history of the Holocaust association that it may have for some people. But I think it's more than that. It's the fact that we sort of distinguish ourselves from animals in some ways. And we're quite happy to sort of trade in wool and animal hair. But human hair, it feels as if we're trading in something that's slightly, yes, almost slightly dodgy. But it's quite interesting for thinking, you know, about how we do make that distinction between animals and humans, because if you actually sort of boil it down to the fiber itself, it's sort of keratin in both cases, and there's very little difference really between human and animal hair.
And it is fascinating, some of the things you discover about the fiber and how it's used. Can you talk about one that was particularly surprising for you?
Yes, I mean, I was very surprised by the different uses that hair had been put. I mean, one was the use of sort of industrial filters for filtering oil in the seed crushing industry in the United States. And human hair filters had been very common up until the Second World War, when the sort of supply of hair from China was sort of cut off to some extent. I was also quite surprised, as I think many of the readers have also been surprised, by the fact that hair had been used for sort of extracting an amino acid called L-cysteine, which had been used quite extensively in the food processing industry. It adds elasticity to dough, so it had been used in things like pizza and bagels, and had also been used as a flavor enhancer. And that trade has officially been sort of banned, the use of sort of human hair-derived products in food. But it may still be going on. It's difficult to trace. It's certainly still being used in sort of animal food and in some face and hair products.
Do you find yourself now walking around looking at people's hair differently?
I do, actually. I have to confess, I do read heads almost too much. I can't help it. And I also, if I see very beautiful hair, I can't help admiring it as well. I mean, I do notice it for sure.
And think, how much would that fetch on the market?
I haven't quite got around to sort of going around with my scissors and sort of chopping it off people's heads, you'll be pleased to hear.
That's really good.
Virginia Prescott there speaking with Emma Charlo, author of Entanglement, The Secret Lives of Hair. You'll find a link to read more about the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Logan Shannon, in for Virginia Prescott. In the mid-19th century, few women worked outside of the home. Even fewer dedicated themselves to scientific study, and it was downright rare for women to be making groundbreaking discoveries at a major university. Yet, as early as the 1880s, Harvard College Observatory employed women as human computers to calculate and interpret observations made by men. As stellar photography advanced through the decades, so did these lady astronomers, who developed a system for classifying stars that is still used by astronomers today. And they discovered novae and created a record of celestial observations on 500,000 photographic plates, a glass universe. Yet the story of their contribution to astronomy is little known, just the kind of hidden history that Dava Sobel excels at. She's author of the best-selling books Longitude, Galileo's Daughter, and The Planets. Her most recent is The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. Virginia spoke with her about the book.
Dava Sobel, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hello, thanks for inviting me.
So I know you've known this story for a long time, but not written about it until now. Why not?
I was a little worried about how to approach the story. There are a lot of characters, and it's a long period of time. It was also irresistible, and I worried about how I would distinguish the women. But fortunately, when I got rolling with the research, I found that some of them had kept diaries, others had written letters, so that their personalities really did come through.
Well, in many ways, this begins with the work of Henry Draper, a gentleman scientist who died quite young, in 1882, a pioneer in stellar photography. Now, what was that, and how did this become a launching point for the work done by the women at Harvard?
The old astronomy had really involved the positions of the stars. People used astronomy as an aid to navigation. But Draper, as an outsider, an amateur, could look at the exciting futuristic science of spectroscopy, which involved splitting the star's light into a colored and marked strip that he could read for the chemical composition of the stars. And he wanted to make photographs of the spectra. This was extremely difficult to do, but he arrived at a technique. He was married to a very wealthy woman who was willing to pay for the whole venture and also to be his partner in this work. She was his assistant. And just as they were ready to embark on a project, he was giving up his teaching. He was a doctor by training, but he was giving all of that up for a life in astronomy when he died suddenly. That left her devastated, and she was determined to see his dream realized, and so she agreed to give the money to the Harvard Observatory to get the work done.
And the Harvard Observatory at that time, headed by a man named Edward Pickering, he began hiring women who would come to be known as Pickering's harem, pejoratively. They were human computers, not yet called astronomers. What were they actually computing?
In the beginning, when Pickering took over the place, they were mostly computing the positions of stars, the orbits of comets. astronomical observatories always had computers. It was a job description long before it was the name of a machine. And in many observatories, the computers were men. But it was unusual at Harvard that the wives, sisters, daughters of the astronomers did this work. And then women were hired from outside the observatory family. And once Pickering had Mrs. Draper's money to run this big project, he hired even more women.
Mrs. Draper, when she was writing to Pickering early on, and I'm not sure that she had the courage to carry on her husband's work by herself, revealing something about her comfort zone. But this is also at a time when women were thought to have delicate constitutions and slightly enfeebled minds, I guess I could say, that shouldn't overexert themselves. Was Pickering a visionary?
I think he was. And he was also a proponent of the higher education of women, which was very controversial at that time. There was an idea that college was bad for women, that it would interfere with their ability to have children. And he thought that was nonsense. And in addition to the women he hired, he also opened the opportunity for the graduates of women's colleges to make their own observations as volunteer observers wherever they lived, and to report all of that to him, to be collated with work done at Harvard and published.
And you point out that we're willing slaves to routine.
And with that, you know, astronomy is arduous, and it's not for everyone, but if it's your passion and you get a chance to do it, you're a happy person.
Well, there are so many fascinating and brilliant women that we learn about here, but I'd like you to narrow it down just a bit. I'm thinking of one of them I just found so fascinating. Is it Wilhelmina Fleming?
Yes, Wilhelmina Fleming. And her situation is so strange because she came to work at the observatory as a maid. She was originally from Scotland, where she'd been a teacher, but she married and emigrated with her husband. And then when she was pregnant, he disappeared from her life. And so she was desperate for a job. And Pickering hired her, but realized she was too smart to waste on the house. And he moved her over to the observatory and taught her how to do the computations that he needed, and also how to look at the photographs and interpret them.
Yeah, and she ended up classifying more than 10,000 stars using a scheme she devised, discovering 10 novae, more than 300 variable stars. And in 1899, when she was, I guess, in her 40s, Pickering urged her to become one of the first women to hold an official title at Harvard University.
He had to convince the university, but she became the first woman to have a university title. She was the curator of astronomical photographs.
Well, once these women's value was shown, their work was, they were diligent and they got to work. Were they paid as well as men?
No. No. And that
Trick
still
question.
Happens today, I might point out. Yes. But that was not a major concern for most of them. Mrs. Fleming did complain that she felt her salary was not as high as the men's, and she was right, even though she was given a tremendous amount of work and responsibility. But at the same time, she was honored to have such a position, to be associated with the observatory and with Pickering, who had really given her a great opportunity.
We're learning about some of the women astronomers who made invaluable contributions to what was then a fledgling field in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and really have forever changed our understanding of the stars. My guest is Dava Sobel. She uncovers this hidden history in her book, The Glass Universe, how the ladies of Harvard Observatory took the measure of the stars. There's been a lot of work on trying to expose women scientists, especially to expose girls or, you know, people of diverse backgrounds in the history of science. But people really didn't know about this story. Why not?
I think astronomers knew about it. I know they did. Partly they knew about it because the work done by the women is still relevant today. And I was eager to make them better known, tell their story, because it's such a happy story. Here they were at a time when most women didn't work outside the home, and yet they had this extraordinary situation. They were given great freedom for their creativity. They did the work. They made discoveries. They got full credit for everything they did. Some of them became members of foreign astronomical societies in addition to the American one. They got to travel and speak about their work. And sometimes they were the only women in a group of scientists talking about a particular topic. And their ability was recognized in their own time. So it's not a chip on the shoulder story.
They were recognized because my impression was outside of this country in a small circle. They basically stepped aside while the men who ruled science kind of basked in their glory.
I wouldn't say that. I think they really always got credit for what they did. They didn't make as much money. And sometimes they weren't free to pursue a line of research that might have appealed to them. But they were always given credit by name for what they did. Mm.
Their legacy, this glass universe, 500,000 glass plates created a catalog of stars still being used today. What has the work of the women at the Harvard Observatory seeded or allowed or that other scientists have built upon?
One thing was just the further education of women. The existence at the observatory of special fellowships for women meant that when the graduate astronomy education program was instituted, the only money available for graduate students was available only for women, so that Harvard's first PhD in astronomy was awarded to a woman, Cecilia Payne.
It really is such an amazing story. And of, you know, a couple of progressive men who saw the potential in these women. And, of course, Anna Draper, who helped fund this program. But we've heard these stories about, you know, the women at NASA, the William at Los Alamos and other sites where the atomic bomb was developed. What, David, do you think it is about science that seemed to be more open for women to work in?
I think women have always been interested in science. They haven't always had easy access, but certain historical situations create an opening, and the ones lucky enough to be nearby can step in and seize that moment.
Virginia Prescott there speaking with Dava Sobel, author of The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. Thanks for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Poddington Bear, David Sezte, Broke for Free, and Blue Dot Sessions. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. If you've missed any part of today's show, fear not. You can catch Word of Mouth anytime you'd like when you subscribe to the Word of Mouth podcast. Here's how you find it. You simply search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And I know you hear us ask this all the time, but if you like the podcast, rate it on iTunes. It makes us feel all warm and fuzzy, but it also helps others find it. I'm Logan Shannon, in for Virginia Prescott. Word of Mouth will be back tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.